Today we're going to begin the last part of the course. There's the part that is talking about quantum energy teleportation. And before going to quantum energy teleportation per se, let's understand a little bit more of the notion of passivity in thermodynamics. All right. So thermal states are passive. I mean, you know probably that if you remember your regular thermodynamics, you want. Which is, you cannot, the definition of passivity is you cannot extract work from a thermal state. There's just no way to extract work from a thermal state. The translation to the, with only one thermal state is what I mean. You have a thermal bath, only one thermal bath, there's no way to run an engine with only one thermal bath, no matter what you do. Now, from a quantum formulation, this translates in the property of thermal states that they are passive. And by that we mean, yeah, with unitary operations on the thermal state, if rho is a thermal state, unitary operations on the thermal state, we yield an average positive energy cost. It's going to cost you energy to do something to a thermal state, all right, unitarily. It has to do with the stability of thermal equilibrium, actually. If you remember when you saw thermodynamics, the second law, and then the stability conditions as second derivatives and so on, this is exactly the manifestation in the formulation of quantum systems. In particular, passivity implies something called local passivity, meaning, well, if no unitary will actually yield a positive work, in particular, no local unitary applied only to one subsystem composing the system. Think of a very hard whatever you want, but it's made of a lot of microconstituents. If you actually do an operation that is local in one of the microconstituents, then that's going to have a positive energy cost. All right? So, well, this is maybe before showing this, let's ask a little question, though. And which is interesting, the formulation of this question came out discussing with sharing insights with my student Dan Grimmer. And I'm going to use some of his insights to illustrate the point that I'm going to make here. Now, imagine that you want to know if the temperature of a state, okay? So I give you a state, I tell you, this is a thermal state, and you want to know its temperature. What will you do?
Take the log.
The what was that?
Take the log and divide by the Hamiltonian.
Ah, but what if you don't know the Hamiltonian?
Tough.
Well, I mean, operationally it's easy, kind of. Get a thermometer, stick it to it. No? Put it into thermal contact with something and let that something thermalize, let that something have a property associated with its temperature, like a thermometer does. This was the notion of empirical temperature. And then you read it out. Now, another option you may have, imagine you have, oh, I give you access to n copies of the system, and then I give you a full quantum lab that can do state tomography with arbitrary precision. Would that be giving you the temperature? So you can know every single element of the density matrix. Would that give you the temperature? That's a lot of information, no? About the state. State tomography is as much information as you can get about the state, it seems. Would that give you the temperature? Not quite. No. If you don't know the Hamiltonian, you won't have the temperature. Easy way, this is the example that Dan cooked up. It's a very easy one. Easy way to see this. So take a thermal state rho. Okay? This thermal state rho is 1 over the partition function E minus beta H. And now do the following transformation. Beta goes to lambda beta and H goes to 1 over lambda h. Different Hamiltonian, different temperature. Same matrix elements. This leaves the matrix invariant. So without knowing the Hamiltonian or something, maybe you don't need to know everything about the Hamiltonian because there is a lot of info in rho about the Hamiltonian. Well, to begin with, it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So its eigenvectors will be the same. Diagonalizing the same basis. And in fact, you also know that thermal states satisfy detailed balance. So the populations are related, the ratio of populations, you know what it is, it's Boltzmann's factors, right? So you can know the difference between the eigenvalues even from the energy. But there's one scale. Well, this scale. There's one scale in the problem that's not given. The scale of the Hamiltonian, you will never know doing tomography. You need to know something about the Hamiltonian of the system. So thermometers cannot be instantaneous. It's not enough with a snapshot. Thermometers cannot take a snapshot. They have to take a video and watch it. Okay, thermometers need to register the dynamics, need to learn about that lambda, if you want, this arbitrary factor that we can rescale the system and still keep the same matrix elements. All right. There you go. Thermalization. So can we extract work from a thermal state if we allow arbitrary operations? Yes. The process of thermalization, thermal contact, gives you a thermal energy flow, but that's not local. You put a thermometer in contact with the, let's say, a constituent of the system, but then you wait, and that weight makes the system evolve according to age, and that makes an energy flow go towards the cold thermometer and makes the temperature go up. This process is non-local. This process involves, it cannot be cast as a general operation on only one subsystem. It involves the whole system because that's the way the thermometer finds out about the Hamiltonian, by letting it evolve freely for a while and letting the thermalization process take a while. Okay? That clear? So yeah, the question, this extracting, for sure you can extract energy from a very hot thing by putting like a very cold in contact and that thing will heat up. Yeah, sure, but that's not a local operation. All right, the thermometer needs to figure out about the Hamiltonian, something about the internal dynamics. Questions? All right. So yeah, this process is non-local. There's an energy flow involving the free evolution of the system that will make the average energy transferred, if you want, can be positive. If your thermometer was originally pretty cold, it will get hotter. Now, let's try to get into an insight on something called strong local passivity. We've seen passivity and local passivity of thermal states. Let's talk about something called strong local passivity. Remember, passivity and local passivity are about unitary operations. You cannot just do a unitary operation locally or globally and extract energy from a thermal state. So imagine that I have a hand. This is Masahiro Hota's hand, for example. We have a hand, and that hand touches a system that is at a high temperature. And the hand is really cold, all right? I don't know, you touch the sun or something like that, or a stove. I mean, maybe you don't want to be as bad. There are hotter things on Earth than the sun, the surface of the sun. And there are comparable things, there have been comparable things on Earth to the surface, to the temperature of the core of the sun, kind of, but that's only in nuclear weapons tests, so not really so common. So, imagine that we touch it, but locally, and by that I mean we don't let time, we just do a local contact, a touch, yeah, like this. If you touch a stove like that, would you get burnt? I guess that's the question. So, no, in general, no. In fact, the hand can get cooler. So this is a property of thermal states that, of course, is dependent on the Hamiltonian, but this property, it's called strong local passivity. Now, if the ground state of the system, say you have this big system with this Hamiltonian age, and let's talk about the ground state of that. If the ground state of the system is max rank entangled, do you know those words? Have you seen those when you see quantum information, what max rank means? Max rank means that it involves the whole Hilbert space. That means the composition of that covers all the possible dimensions. Okay? That's what it means, max rank. It's not like entanglement. Imagine you have a tripartite system. Well, 1 root 2, 0, 0 plus 1, 1 would not be max rank. It's rank 2. There's only in the decomposition, there's only two terms. Now you have A0, 0 plus B1, 1 plus C2, 2, that would be max rank entangled. Okay, that's what it means. That means the composition involves all the dimensions of the Hilbert space. Okay? Now, if the ground state is like that, if the ground state is entangled and the entanglement is max rank, again, a property on its Smith decomposition, not necessarily maximal entanglement, just max rank, okay? Then there exists a temperature larger than zero for which, if the temperature of the system is below this critical temperature, is not possible to extract work from the system through any local CPTP map. Let's understand the claim. It means that if the ground state contains max rank entanglement, then there exists a finite temperature under which just touching the system will not get you hotter, ever. Is that understood? That's called strong local passivity. So thermal states under the critical temperature T star are strong local passive. There's no way to extract energy from them through just local operations. That's the notion of if you touch a system really, really fast, you will not get burned. In fact, you can get colder. Is that clear? You can find the proof of the theorem in general in this paper. Is that understood? That's super important, and that tells you a lot about thermodynamics. In particular, for any temperature below T star includes temperature T equals zero, the ground state. Huh? It includes the... So you see, can you extract energy from ground states? That's the question that, I don't know, it's one of the favorite topics of crackpots in general to write. Like, can we extract zero-point energy and use it? Energy from the vacuum? Can we extract energy from the ground state? Locally. Well, this theorem tells you that in quantum fields in particular, just to say, to mention something, in quantum fields, the ground state is entangled and is max rank entangled, by the way, among like the different, like, if you actually do a difficult though, but a tensor decomposition in space like separated regions, there is max rank entanglement there. So a quantum field is a particular case of this. And in particular for T equals zero, because T star is larger than zero, it's true that it's strong local passive, so you cannot do it with just touching the vacuum. Okay. How about... Oh yeah, this is an illustration of what I just said, right? So you touch, and actually you have a strong point contact, so short duration. What you're doing, even if your hand was already cold, and this was hotter, you're actually injecting energy into the system on average, you're not getting energy out. Okay, so this hand is going to be, wow, it's actually cold. All right. Now, there is a way. Yeah, go for it.
So in max rank entanglement, does every state in the Hilbert space have to be entangled with every other state, or at least?
No. A state can be max rank entangled.
Yeah.
So it means, again, max rank.
In the basis, sorry. You pick a basis for the Hilbert space.
Yeah.
So does a state have to contain every single one of the states in that basis? And
yes.
Every single one of those states have to be entangled with every other one of the states, or at least one other state?
Not sure if I understand the question. What it means, the Smith decomposition contains all the terms. You know what the Smith decomposition is? So the Smith decomposition of the entangled state contains all the dimensions. So it goes on a sum from one to the dimension where the coefficients there are non-zero for all of them.
Okay.
That's my max rank entanglement.
Okay.
All right? So again, example. One root two, A 0, 0 plus B 1, 1 is only max rank entanglement if the dimension of your Hilbert space is 2. If it's 3, it's not max rank entangled. Max rank entangled would be, for example, A 0, 0 plus B 1, 1 plus C 2, 2. That's max rank in 3 dimensions, but not in 4. See what I mean?
Wait, sorry. For 2 qubits, you're...
For 2 qubits, max rank is this. Oh. This is max rank for 2 qubits.
Why not the other 2? I mean, your dimension is 4, so shouldn't you have 4 states? Oh, okay.
It's 2 qubits. No, it's the Smith decomposition. So it's the dimension of any of the systems. All right? So this is max rank. For 3? B. This is max rank for 3. Okay, get the idea?
In the Schmidt decomposition, the number of terms, it's dependent on the Hilbert space of each individual.
That's right. So, for example, you have different dimensions in the two systems. The definition of max rank is the smaller dimension. Okay? All right, then. So, can we cheat this? So this is a thermodynamic property. Is it possible to cheat it? Can you actually cheat it? Adding what, or in the formulation of resource theory, what is the minimum amount of things that you need to do in order to cheat that limitation? Is there any way that I can actually extract energy from local operations? And I said, yeah, but you need to allow one more thing. That is not too expensive from the point of view of Quantum Info. If you allowed LOCC, so if you allow two partners to work locally and allow them the ability to communicate, then you can cheat this limitation. That's what we're going to see today. We're going to see an example of a protocol where they can cheat this limitation and actually extract energy from a ground state. Well, struct is too strong. One of them will extract, the other will have to pay a price, okay? As we will see. So, A carries a measurement on some part of the system, all right? That measurement proportions A, gives A some information. That information can be sent to B, and then B knows what to do unitarily in the protocol we're gonna see. B knows what to do in order to have a negative energy cost on average. One way of thinking about this is the following. I mean, one, just to give some intuition. Imagine, a field or harmonic oscillator, your favorite quantum system. Harmonic oscillator is nice, or a field, because you can think of phase space. Okay? Say, think of the Wigner function of that, the distribution. The vacuum. The vacuum, or the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, is just a Gaussian center at zero. Okay? Now, if you start trying to extract energy from it, well, sometimes you're gonna catch a fluctuation, maybe that is a negative energy fluctuation. Sometimes you're gonna catch a positive one. On average, the cost is gonna be larger or equal than zero. And because the operation you're doing is definitely gonna probably cost you some energy, if you don't commute with the Hamiltonian, then it's gonna cost you some energy, the cost on average will be larger than zero. So you cannot do that from the ground state. Now think of the following. Imagine that this is not this yet, but imagine that someone actually pushes the state. That's a displacement, okay? It's in the vacuum, the ground state, then pushes the state, and the state starts rotating in phase space. Now, can you extract energy from it? Well, if you try again, sometimes you're gonna do the wrong thing, and you're gonna push in the wrong direction, and you're gonna increase the displacement, that's gonna cost you. Sometimes you may return it a little bit towards zero, and that's gonna give energy away. On average, you don't know. Now, if someone actually pushes it, and gets information out of that push, and tells you, I actually pushed it this way, then you think, right, I'll just wait a little bit until I catch the state exactly. I'm gonna do this push, but I'm gonna wait for the state to actually come here, then I push it towards the center, then I get it closer to the vacuum, I extract some energy from it. This is the same, but with entanglement. So you have two harmonic oscillators if you want. They're in the ground state, so they do something to one of the harmonic oscillators. By doing that, because of the entanglement, they learn some information about the spectrum of fluctuations of the other one, or how it's rotating. And then the other person with that information can actually figure out the best way to push so that I catch only a negative energy fluctuation. This is the intuitive way. We're going to see rigorously what this means. Questions about that? This protocol is what we call quantum energy teleportation. That's a question? No, okay. This protocol is what we call quantum energy teleportation. And it's a protocol that was devised by Masahiro Hota in Japan, in Sendai, Tohoku University. Remember that paper that I mentioned, Progress on Theoretical Physics, Takagi? That paper, the professor there was a professor of Hota, just so you know, in the same university, Tohoku. So they have a tradition of really great people working on quantum field theory. Anyway. Well, that's exactly what I just said. So the important thing, though, is, as we will see, A is not sending energy to B. A sends information to B that we know does not imply sending energy, right? We learned recently. I mean, of course, you can send information with an arbitrary low-frequency photon or with no photons at all, as we know, okay? So A needs to send information to B. Just information, not energy. Energy never travels from A to B. Now, in fact, the operation, the POVM, because you're acting on the ground state first, all that you can do to the ground state is what? Can you de-excite the ground state? No. All that you can do is exciting it. And that's gonna cost you energy on average. The delta energy is gonna be positive. So A is actually inputting energy into the system. And B is extracting energy from what locally looks like the vacuum, because locally is the vacuum, the ground state, but globally is not the ground state. It's gonna extract some energy. This energy is always gonna be less than the energy inputted, otherwise we would have a problem. For example, we would violate things like the quantum interest conjecture and things like those. Anyway, So the energy extracted here is less than EA. And then because it's EA inputs energy in the measurement and sends the information and B extracts energy, we call this energy teleportation. Energy was here, and now it's here. That's the origin of the name. OK, so this we will do later. Because now we're going to derive the math of the protocol. So now it's the story that I told you. Let's see that it actually works. And maybe let's switch on the lights if it's possible. Yeah, nice. Also, yeah, perfect. Thank you. All right, let's derive what is known as minimal QET model. And it's minimal because it's the simplest system where you can actually make it work, which is as oftentimes 2 qubits. A and B. And the following Hamiltonian. What is the key to having max rank entanglement? The key to having max rank entanglement in the ground state is that if you have an interaction between the constituents of the system, the interaction should not commute with the free part of Hamiltonian. And the less they commute, the better it's going to be for this. Anyway, following Hamiltonian. So we have H is going to be HA plus HB plus some interaction part between them. Okay? Now let's pick particular examples to illustrate this in a much more easier way. So we want HA, let's say, is some scale sigma A, sigma set A. Plus, let me add a multiple of the identity, which I don't need, by the way. I could do the whole thing without the multiple of the identity, but it's going to make the calculations nicer and actually going to dispel some misconceptions thanks to using that. So let's just add it, if you don't mind. Some multiple of the identity that is function of H and another parameter K that is going to be the coupling strength. Okay. As you know, adding multiples of the identity does nothing. Okay, just rescales the ground state energy. Okay, I want to rescale it. This multiple of the identity is added, so every Hamiltonian here has an expectation of zero in the ground state. That's all. That simplifies things a bit. HB. HBZ. Plus the same multiple of the identity. And then V is equal to twice K sigma XA sigma XB plus K square divided by H square, multiple of the identity, the same one. All right. So the important bits here are not the multiples of the identity, because that's irrelevant. That just rescales the energy of the ground state. And all the others, of course, is a constant displacement in the energy spectrum. We get sigma z for the first free Hamiltonian with an energy h. Sigma z for the Hamiltonian of the second system, again, with an energy h. So the energy of these two systems could have been, if we have only that, minus h or h. OK, but then we added this multiple of the identity that will displace it to zero, all of them for the ground state. Not all of them, for the ground state. And then the interaction Hamiltonian, the important thing is that it's an XX kind of interaction, something that does not commute with the free part. OK. Let me give you F to make the whole thing zero. Not the whole thing, the expectation of every term zero. So if we pick F of HK to be equal to h squared divided by the square root of h squared plus k squared, then the expectation value on the ground state of the full system of the Hamiltonian is zero, but of course it's the ground state, by definition will be the smallest one, and I'm renormalizing it to zero, but actually doing that is zero for every single term in the full Hamiltonian. All right, by picking this F, we make all the expectations zero. Okay, so H, so we know H is non-negative. That simplifies a bit the calculation. All right, this is the setup. The setup is two qubits that are coupled in that way, with a coupling that is XX non-commuting with the free Hamiltonians. All right. No. Now, the ground state we can compute. In fact, I think it fits here and it's nice to have it there. The ground state of the Hamiltonian is not difficult to compute. You can do it yourself. It's a 4x4 diagonalization. And it's a simple one, actually. It's of the form, ground is of the form 1 root 2 that multiplies square root of 1 minus f of hk divided by h, 1 a, 1 b, minus root of 1 plus f hk divided by h, 0 a, 0 b. Yep. That's the ground state. Where 0, of course, 0 and I. Yeah. 0 and I is right. This nu is of course a or b, and this is the nu, a or b. Right. So, and the one is the other one. So zero and I, as usual, are the eigen is the eigenvectors of sigma z. Yeah.
If f is only shifting the energy,
indeed.
Why is it also affecting the amplitudes of, or the relative?
Sorry, what?
Like, why is it also affecting the relative weights of 1, 1 and 0, 0? Like, I feel like f shouldn't appear in the ground state.
But it does. In this basis. If this is, yeah, in this basis. If you actually write in a basis of an operator that is displaced, it will not be there. So you're displacing the operator. You're doing something to the operator. You're changing the energy spectrum. Of course, it's going to depend on how much you displace it, yeah. To the calculation, you'll see.
Okay.
It's not difficult, though. So F is modifying the operator. Okay, question. The eigenvalues of A are the same as the eigenvalues of A minus D identity? Do they have the same eigenvalues? Do they have the same eigenvectors?
Of H, or the eigenvalues of what?
The eigenvalues would not be the same. Of the matrix A and the matrix A minus D identity, where D is a constant. That's this. Okay, if we express in terms of the displaced eigenvectors, the ones that have eigenvalues 0 and whatever, 0 and 2, then this won't be here. And then you'll have the h here.
Well, what does f have to do with the eigenvectors of sigma z?
Nothing. I'm expressing this in terms of the eigenvectors of sigma z. Anyway, so this is an easy way. There's an easy way to solve it. Diagonalize this. And you'll find that you have a dependence on f. OK? All right. So let's check that everything, I mean, the dependence on F is not really a dependence on F, if you want. It's a dependence on H and K. All right, so you will have, if you have this F equal to 0, then you will have, keep in mind that if F equal to 0, this is not well defined. You will have the dependence on H and K coming from a different way. This in the limit that K goes to 0, that you don't have coupling, what is the ground state? What is the ground state if F is zero? Sorry, if K is zero. Can you substitute and tell me?
Yeah, it's just the...
The zero, zero, right? So indeed, this thing has to depend on K. The fact that it's a function of the F is just because we have an F. So you will have the dependence anyways if you diagonalize. Instead of writing F, I write this expression, would you be happier?
That's
probably why, yes.
If all the identities, if you remove that from the Hamiltonian, that F would still be there. That's what I'm...
No. You will have here H squared.
Yeah.
H root of H squared plus K squared.
Yeah, sure.
Ah, that's what you will have no matter what.
Yes, okay.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? So if you actually explore in terms of these bases, you can have this factor, and it so happens to coincide with this. So let me put it a different way. What we did, if you want, is we diagonalize first. And then after diagonalizing, you can say, oh, wow, it'd be much simpler if I actually add this shift of the multiple of the identity. I'm going to have local energies equal to zero and the total, the interaction term equal to zero. And also, I can express this as a function of it. Okay, maybe think of it as a posteriori kind of thing. That's probably easier. But yeah, no, indeed. This thing has to depend on H and K because those are the parameters of the interaction. So let me just write it again. F HK divided by H. All right, so when K is equal to zero, this state is just as expected, right? If you don't have interaction, it's going to be the ground state of sigma z. Okay? Yeah, the F, what it's going to do is, what is the energy of it in the ground state? Okay, is it minus 2 or is it 0? That's the difference of including the F or not in the Hamiltonian. And that you're totally right. It's a displacement on the eigenvalues, not on the eigenvectors. Because identity commutes with the matrix you diagonalize. The writing the F here is a convenience. Okay. All right then. Everyone's happy with this? If we have K go to infinity, what is the state, the ground state? So if the coupling is infinite, infinitely strong, what is the ground state? So what happens with this if K goes to infinity? Seriously. It goes to what? K is this. Take it to infinity. What do you get for F?
Zero.
So if you get a zero, you get the maximally entangled state. Okay? So if the coupling is infinitely strong, the ground state is maximally entangled. If the couple is infinitely weak, the ground state has no entanglement at all. It's just a zero, zero. Everyone happy? I hope. You've seen things like that before, right? I mean, yeah, I'm hoping. All right. All right, so all that we have is someone has given us a Hamiltonian that couples two qubits to each other in a way that doesn't commute with the free Hamiltonian, right? And then we diagonalize it, we have a ground state, and we know the ground state is more entangled, the stronger the interaction. And for any non-zero interaction, this is maybe not too much entanglement if it's weak, but it's max rank. It involves 1, 1, and 0, 0. So it's one of those states that satisfies the premises of the theorem. So we know that there is a T star for this system, under which it's going to be strong local passive, and under which we're going to be able to cheat it with LOCC. All right? And in particular, that implies also that it's true for the ground state. That's this, for the purposes of this, this is the striking result. It seems that with local operations, we're going to be able to extract energy from the ground state with local operations. That is non-trivial. Well, plus classical communication. But you see that in quantum info, often this is considered kind of for free. Yeah? So anyway. Protocol. Protocol, several steps. One, I mean, I'm going to give you the simplest, the minimal one. The minimal one uses projective measurements. As probably we will discuss in the last tutorial, you don't need projective measurements for this. You can do it with POVMs. Now, that means you can do it with quantum systems too, coupling quantum systems to it. OK? As detectors. OK. We start from the ground state. Two, Alice carries out a projective measurement. Again, doesn't need to be, it's just for the simpler model that we're seeing, projective measurement is enough. So assume that Alice has the power to do projective measurements on their subsystem. If it's a qubit, can measure in one of whatever basis it wants, but in particular, it's going to measure in the x spaces. Projective measurements of sigma xa. Then again, this is not too much power. This is the power of measuring locally, only acting on her qubit. Not allowed to touch Bob's qubit, okay? Repeat it many times, just on a note, repeat it many times. This will have an average that we will compute anyway. Average energy cost EPA larger than zero. Which makes sense, right? Because we start from the ground state, we're doing something to the ground state and changing it, right? Sometimes she will measure the eigenstate probabilistically, right? Because it kind of has some 0, 0, 1, 1 components. So sometimes she would get the excited state, sometimes she will get the ground state, but on average, the energy cost is gonna be positive. She's gonna increase the energy of the system, okay? We will see it in detail. But I just want you to know that, of course, if you do something to the ground state, you're not gonna de-excite it, you're gonna excite it. Or nothing. But in particular, this projective measurement on that state is always, the average cost is always larger than zero. Okay? Three. The result of the measurement, how much information does Alice get when she measures? How much? In bits. If you measure sigma x of a qubit, how much information do you get?
One bit,
either a one or a zero, or a plus or minus one. If it's sigma x that you're measuring, plus or minus one. Okay? So alpha, one bit, alpha could be plus or minus one, is announced to Bob through a classical channel. It doesn't have to be classical, actually. It could be quantum. But in this particular implementation, that is supposed to be, that can be fast. What does it mean to be fast in this context? If I say fast, I mean, in physics, you cannot say just fast. Right? You need to say fast as compared to something. What is the meaning of fast here? We want it to be fast. So we will do all this rigorously, okay? So here we are like introducing the ideas, the physical concepts, but we're gonna do it rigorously. We want to do quantum energy teleportation. So we don't want, there's an energy cost of doing something on A. And of course the systems are coupled. So energy may flow from A to B, right? You do something on A, energy may flow from A to B. We don't want that to happen because we want to have genuine quantum energy teleportation. So we don't want A to send the information, to send the energy to B because, you know, there's something here and the energy propagates. So the communication has to be much faster than the time it takes for the energy to travel from A to B. We will compute that time scale, but can you guess it? What's that time scale? Looking at the Hamiltonian, what will be the time scale of energy flow from A to B? Any guesses? Would it be h? Doesn't look like it, no? Would it be k? Ah, what about 1 over k? OK, it's 1 over k. This is a coupling frequency, k. Huh? 1 over k is the time associated with this Hamiltonian. Look, this Hamiltonian is generating time evolutions with a parameter k, the interaction one. Okay, so having energy transfers through this interaction term will take a time 1 over k. Okay, that's the scale. So we want to be the speed of this communication to be much larger than 1 over k. We will. Don't worry, we will see all that in math. Yeah? So this is just discussing the physics first. I think it's neat, no? Okay. 4. 4 and last. With the information of the outcome measurement, So the information that Alice sent to Bob, Bob carries out an informed local unitary. Let's call it U alpha. Right? Bob performs a local unitary that depends on the outcome of Alice's measurement. Alice informs Bob, and Bob decides, like in quantum teleportation that you surely have seen, the action of Bob is dependent on what Alice got in the measurement. So Alice sends the bit to Bob, and Bob tailors the unitary to that information. Okay? After many repetitions of the protocol, of this protocol, the average energy cost of Bob's unitary will be negative. All right? So Bob is extracting energy from the system. On average, after repeating this protocol many times, Bob is actually doing something to the system. Sometimes we'll put energy, sometimes we'll extract energy. Of course, it's all probabilistic. But on average, when you repeat many times, Bob is going to have an average negative energy cost. Bob is going to retrieve energy from his local operation. And keep in mind that locally, B, the qubit B looks like if A is still, the system A, B is still in the ground state. Locally, this is the vacuum. If you trace A, B looks like in the ground state, like it should, because the communication is fast. Think of it as instantaneous, okay, if you want to. All right, questions so far. We're going to make this protocol math now and see what happens. Do we understand the protocol? Very simple, huh? Start from the ground state. Alice measures locally. Alice has access to half of the ground state, the local part. And in that part, Alice carries on a projective measurement on an observable that does not commute with the free Hamiltonian of Alice. Then Alice obtains a bit in this case, because it's a two-level system. And that bit is sent to Bob. And then Bob, with that bit, does a unitary operation that is informed, is dependent on alpha, on the result of the measurement. They repeat the process many times, so the average energy cost of that process is going to be negative for Bob. The average energy cost of the unitary, the informed unitary, is going to be negative for Bob. If there are no questions, let's proceed. Okay, step one. Average energy cost of the PVM on A. All right, so Alice measures sigma x and obtains alpha that could be plus or minus one. What is the action of that measurement? Well, it's a projective measurement, so it's going to be a renormalized projector, right? So Alice carries the projection and renormalizes. So Alice applies the following projector, PA of alpha. Of course, it's the different projector if C measures one or minus one. So it's 1/2, 1 plus alpha sigma xA. This is just, right, it's going to be plus plus if C measures a one and minus minus if C measures a minus one. Okay? It's projecting on the eigenstate of the eigenvalue C obtained. Okay? So if you substitute here, you will get a projector on the positive, so the plus plus, the plus, or the minus. Okay? So in a single shot, in a single shot measurement, PVM, let's call it PVM, by what it is, the post measurement state is, let's call it post measurement, of course depends on alpha, and is 1 over square root of p alpha, probability of finding alpha, pH of alpha on the ground, where that may be dangerous, where p alpha is just, of course, the ground expectation of that projector, so the probability of finding the right outcome. That's what you normalize with. PA alpha on ground. All right, so that's what happens after doing the projective measurement. Alice does the projective measurement, and the updated state is this, okay, using the rule of what you do when you do projective measurements. Yep.
Sorry, so she does two measurements?
Only one.
So what is alpha?
I mean, the outcome of the measurement.
So, but it looks like the measurement she does depends on alpha.
Well, definitely.
But so she gets alpha and then she...
The result, the project. What do you do when you have a projective measurement? You obtain a value and you project on the eigenvector of that value.
I see.
So of course the projector is different depending on what you got.
Sorry.
This is literally a projector on plus plus if you obtain a 1, and a projector on 1 minus minus you obtain a minus. We need that information in this form because we want to do a statistical ensemble of many times. All right. So I appreciate the question though. Like the questions are super welcome. I mean, I'm not aware of what could be subtle or not sometimes. All right. So say that we repeat this projection on an ensemble of identical setups. Okay? We're gonna do this many times. If we repeat this projection on an ensemble of identical setups, then the post-measurement state is the statistical, well, the post-measurement state of the ensemble is, well, what is going to be? Well, it's going to be a density matrix that is built out of the probability of getting one outcome or getting the other. What happens if you do the first one with the probability of that happening per single shot, plus the probability of the second thing, the obtaining the minus one, times the post-measurement state of obtaining the minus one. So let's call it rho one. This is the sum on all possible outcomes of the probability of getting the outcome, and then the post-measurement state associated with that outcome. That's the ensemble of doing this many times. We can simplify this, because these things depends on the square root of, this is normalized to square root of p alpha, so the p alphas are going to cancel, and what we're left with is just the projection alpha acting on the ground and the projection alpha. But of course, P is alpha joint, it's a projection. So this is literally the projection. Okay. All right. Questions? So this is the post-measurement state when we do it many times. We are repeating the process many times. Okay. Cool. Let's compute the energy cost of doing this, the average energy cost of doing this. That may not be so visible, huh? Okay. Yeah. the average energy cost of step one is, of course, trace of rho one h, right? The energy of the final state minus, well, let me just give it a name, EPA. That's the name we gave it. EPA is equal minus, the, of course, the energy of the initial state, which is the ground state. Okay, this is the ground state. With the full Hamiltonian, of course. But we know what the energy of the ground state is, right? What's the energy of the ground state? Look at the third line in the first board. What's the energy of the ground state? Can you read it out from there and tell me? Can't see it from here.
Zero.
This is equal to the trace of rho 1, forgetting hats everywhere, rho 1 h. Okay, that's the energy cost of the first step. So we can compute it. Let's just compute it and stop here when we compute it. All right, EPA is equal to, let's do that trace, alpha equals to plus minus 1 of GPA alpha H PA alpha ground. Of course, the trace would be a sum over the ground and the excited, a complete basis, but because this thing only has contributions from the ground if you expand this projector here. So what you get is the sum of, you have three terms here, alpha equals plus minus 1 of three terms, G PA alpha, HA PA alpha, ground, term number 1. Term number 2, A plus minus 1 G PA alpha, HB PA alpha, ground plus sum alpha plus minus 1 of, where's it? Yeah, perfect. G PA alpha V PA alpha ground. So these three things are actually simple to compute, mostly because, ow. We can note that P alpha commutes with HB. Obviously, there's no operators on B, on PA. Also, PA alpha commutes with V, right? Because it's sigma x, and V is proportional to sigma x and the identity. All right? So we can express, we can find, so, well, I'll try to write it here. Sum alpha equals plus minus 1 of G PA alpha HB PA alpha G is actually equal to G HB PA alpha, right? Out of commuting them. And that's equal to 1 over 2 sum over alpha equals plus minus 1 of G HB G plus, just substituting the projector, alpha G HB sigma XA. And how much is that? How much is that? Can you just substitute the state and tell me? What is the expectation of HB on the ground state? Is the expectation of this thing is proportional to the expectation of 0b, hb, 0b, isn't it? Well,
zero.
Zero, because we know that the expectation of g is zero by the third line in there. So this thing is actually zero. And what is this one? Because of time, this one I let it for you as homework, if you want. The total value of this is zero, so you know what is the result is. Okay, compute it, prove it for me. It's not difficult, it's just substituting. Okay? This whole thing is zero. And since, I mean, it's not difficult to see, right? Because this thing is gonna be proportional, because maybe you're not gonna do it, I don't know. This thing is proportional to G sigma X A G, right? And this thing is proportional, well, no, not really. This thing here is proportional to G sigma set B sigma set A. Prove that this thing is proportional to this. Okay, and therefore you know it's zero. Okay, prove it. It's not difficult. It's actually very simple. And then similarly, and then just to finish with that. And similarly, sum alpha equals plus minus one of G PA alpha V PA alpha. G, it's equal to the sum alpha equals plus minus one of G because of the commutation V P alpha P A alpha G, and the same thing substituting alpha equals plus minus one of G of V, which we know what it is. What is this already? Alpha G V sigma x a g. What is this? From the third line in the first board. What is that? Zero. What is this? Well, this thing you can check that is proportional to the expectation on g of sigma x b, which is going to be zero as well. So the whole thing is zero. Make sure that you check these two steps at least. All right. So of all these terms here, there's only one of them that actually contributes that I'm going to write. So I want the back here. I guess this. Right? So E, the cost of this projective measurement on average, it's equal to, again, let me just rewrite it, the trace of rho 1 h minus the trace of the ground state. Oh, did I call it ground or zero? Ground, right? Yeah, ground. Ground H, right? The result is, which is what we just computed, that this is just sum alpha equals plus minus one G PA alpha HA PA alpha G. And do the substitutions for me. It's very simple algebra. It's just the algebra of SU2 and commuting and applying and using a basis and evaluating. This thing is pretty simple. This thing is actually F of HK larger than zero. Again, the point that Kefir pointed out, which is important, this is not f because we had an f at the beginning. This is because the expression regarding of the f at the beginning will be h squared divided by the root of h squared plus k squared. So we can write as f. just as a shorthand, okay? So this is larger than zero, as you can check, because the constants here are all squared, and this is the positive square root. Okay? So the energy cost, and please do the mission. I feel bad on giving you, not showing you stuff. I know it's super simple, and that may make people think it's kind of boring because this is simple. But I don't know, please do it. So I don't want you to believe. Do it. That's kind of important for me, if you can do it. You don't need to tell me, but do it. We computed the energy cost of doing the first projective measurement many times to an ensemble of identical systems. And the result is, of course, larger than zero. All right? In a single shot, that doesn't make any sense because the result depends on the outcome of the measurement, right? So there's not an energy cost per single shot. It's probabilistic, all right? But on average, if you do it to an ensemble of systems, you know what it is, and then you're paying a price, which makes sense, no? You had the ground state, you're doing something to it, you're changing it, therefore, that's going to cost you. You're going to excite the system. Tomorrow, we will continue with the protocol, and we'll do, we've done two. We need to do three now. Okay, and see what happens on three. Any questions? All right, so we will see next, tomorrow, the last day. We will finish this, and because it's the last day and so on, we will have a little bit of fun with it, which is like, let's try to apply to quantum field theory and see if we can generate exotic distributions of matter and see if we can get negative energy distributions and all the stuff that violates energy conditions. That's going to be like the end note. And I'll try to make it fun as much as I can because it's the last lecture too. So don't miss the last lecture. I guess that's the, that's the message. See you tomorrow.